Sweet Love House, and who worked through the week as a merchant banker in London. There was a whiff of penance in Aubrey's involvement in local affairs, a sense that he ought to make right the wrong that his father had so carelessly done to the little town. He and his wife Julia donated and gave out prizes at the agricultural show, sat on any number of local committees, and threw an annual Christmas party to which invitations were much coveted. It was Howard's pride and delight to think that he and Aubrey were such close allies in the continuing quest to reassign the fields to Yarville, because Aubrey moved in a higher sphere of commerce that commanded Howard's fascinated respect. Every evening, after the delicatessen closed, Howard removed the tray of his old-fashioned till and counted up coins and dirty notes before placing them in a safe. Aubrey, on the other hand, never touched money during his office hours, and yet he caused it to move in unimaginable quantities across continents. He managed it and multiplied it, and, when the portents were less propitious, he watched magisterially as it vanished. To Howard, Aubrey had a mystique that not even a worldwide financial crash could dent. The delicatessen owner was impatient of anyone who blamed the likes of Aubrey for the mess in which the country found itself. No one had complained when things were going well, was Howard's oft-repeated view, and he accorded Aubrey the respect due to a general injured in an unpopular war. Meanwhile, as a district councillor, Aubrey was privy to all kinds of interesting statistics, and in a position to share a good deal of information with Howard about Pagford's troublesome satellite. The two men knew exactly how much of the district's resources were poured, without return or apparent improvement, into the fields' dilapidated streets, that nobody owned their own house in the fields, whereas the red brick houses of the Cantermill estate were almost all in private hands these days. They had been prettified almost beyond recognition, with window boxes and porches and neat front lawns, that nearly two-thirds of fields' dwellers lived entirely off the state, and that a sizable proportion passed through the doors of the Bell Chapel Addiction Clinic. 6. Howard carried the mental image of the fields with him always, like a memory of a nightmare. Boarded windows daubed with obscenities, smoking teenagers loitering in the perennially defaced bus shelters, satellite dishes everywhere, turned to the skies like the denuded ovules of grim metal flowers. He often asked, rhetorically, why they could not have organized and made the place over, what was stopping the residents from pooling their meager resources and buying a lawnmower between the lot of them. But it never happened. The fields waited for the councils, district and parish, to clean, to repair, to maintain, to give and give and give again. Howard would then recall the Hope Street of his boyhood, with its tiny back gardens, each hardly more than tablecloth-sized squares of earth, but most, including his mother's, bristling with runner beans and potatoes. There was nothing, as far as Howard could see, to stop the fielders growing fresh vegetables, nothing to stop them disciplining their sinister, hooded, spray-painting offspring, nothing to stop them pulling themselves together as a community and tackling the dirt and the shabbiness, nothing to stop them cleaning themselves up and taking jobs, nothing at all. So Howard was forced to draw the conclusion that they were choosing, of their own free will, to live the way they lived, and that the estate's air of slightly threatening degradation was nothing more than a physical manifestation of ignorance and indolence. Pagford, by contrast, shone with a kind of moral radiance in Howard's mind, as though the collective soul of the community was made manifest in its cobbled streets, its hills, its picturesque houses. To Howard, his birthplace was much more than a collection of old buildings and a fast-flowing, tree-fringed river. The majestic silhouette of the abbey above, or the hanging baskets in the square. For him, the town was an ideal, a way of being. A micro-civilization that stood firmly against a national decline. "I'm a Pagford man," he would tell summertime tourists, "born and bred." In so saying, he was giving himself a profound compliment, disguised as a commonplace. He had been born in Pagford, and he would die there. And he had never dreamed of leaving, nor itched for more change of scene than could be had from watching the seasons transform the surrounding woods and river, from watching the square blossom in spring or sparkle at Christmas. Barry Fairbrother had known all this. Indeed, he had said it. He had laughed right across the table in the town hall, laughed right in Howard's face. "You know, Howard, you are Pagford to me." And Howard, not discomposed in the slightest, for he had always met Barry joke for joke, had said, "I'll take that as a great compliment, Barry, however it was intended." He could afford to laugh. The one remaining ambition of Howard's life was within touching distance. The return of the fields to Yarville seemed imminent and certain. Then, 2 days before Barry Fairbrother had dropped dead in a car park, Howard had learned from an unimpeachable source that his opponent had broken all known rules of engagement and had gone to the local paper with a story about the blessing it had been for Crystal Whedon to be educated at St. Thomas's. The idea of Crystal Whedon being paraded in front of the reading public as an example of the successful integration of the Fields and Pagford might, so Howard said, have been funny, had it not been so serious. Doubtless, Fairbrother would have coached the girl, and the truth about her foul mouth, the endlessly interrupted classes, and other children in tears, the constant removals and reintegrations, would be lost in lies. Howard trusted the good sense of his fellow townsfolk, but he feared journalistic spin and the interference of ignorant do-gooders. His objection was both principled and personal. He had not yet forgotten how his granddaughter had sobbed in his arms, with bloody sockets where her teeth had been, while he tried to soothe her with a promise of triple prizes from the tooth fairy. Tuesday. 1. 2 mornings after her husband's death, Mary Fairbrother woke at 5 o'clock. She'd slept in the marital bed with her 12-year-old Declan, who had crawled in sobbing shortly before dawn. He was sound asleep now, so Mary crept out of the room and went down into the kitchen to cry more freely. Every hour that passed added to her grief, because it bore her further away from the living man, and because it was a tiny foretaste of the eternity she would have to spend without him. Again and again she found herself forgetting, for the space of a heartbeat, that he was gone forever, and that she could not turn to him for comfort. When her sister and brother-in-law came through to make breakfast, Mary took Barry's phone and withdrew into the study, where she started looking for the numbers of some of Barry's huge acquaintance. She'd only been at it a matter of minutes when the mobile in her hands rang. "Yes," she murmured. "Oh, hello. I'm looking for Barry Fairbrother. Alison Jenkins from the Yarville and District Gazette." The young woman's jaunty voice was as loud and horrible in Mary's ear as a triumphal fanfare. The blast of it obliterated the sense of the words. "Sorry. Alison Jenkins from the Yarville and District Gazette. I want to speak to Barry Fairbrother. It's about his article on the Fields." "Oh," said Mary. "Yes, he hasn't attached details of this girl he talks about. We're supposed to interview her. Crystal Whedon?" Each word felt to Mary like a slap. Perversely, she sat still and silent in Barry's old swivel chair and let the blows rain upon her. "Can you hear me?" "Yes," said Mary, her voice cracking. "I can hear you. I know Mr. Fairbrother was very keen to be present when we interviewed Crystal, but time's running, he won't be able to be present," said Mary, her voice eliding into a screech. "He won't be able to talk about the bloody Fields anymore, or about anything, ever again." "What?" said the girl on the end of the line. "My husband is dead, all right? He's dead. So the Fields will have to get on without him, won't they?" Mary's hands were shaking so much that the mobile slipped through her fingers, and for the few moments before she managed to cut the call, she knew that the